For many, many years, the Institute has gone along on the strength of the proceeds earned from subscriptions for memberships and donations. We have never been able to give benefit of tax deductibility to those who have donated. We're now able to do that, and we naturally expect a flood of money to engulf us. Well, I tell you, we'll welcome it. I welcome on your behalf Dr. John Martin Kitchen. Our very youthful-looking speaker has a worldwide reputation as an historian of late 19th and early 20th century German military political matters. When I tell you that he was elected a fellow by the Royal Fellows of the Royal Historical Society within 5 years of the publication of his thesis, I think you will agree with me that we should not be disarmed by his young-looking face. He has not always been a scholar, and I'll come back to that. He was born in Nottingham in 1936. To make a point, I have to tell you that his father was a director of a life insurance company, improbably called Scottish Widows Life Insurance Company. Now, don't smile. Dr. Kitchen assures me that while the company actually began business in Scotland insuring widows, it's now one of the largest life companies in England. Our speaker was schooled at Sherborne Public School in Dorset. Dr. Kitchen says reflectively, "I was quite well taught." He went to Oxford, Magdalen College, where he read history, graduating in 1961. He had as his tutor there A.J.P. Taylor, a modern European diplomatic historian. Some of you will know Professor Taylor as the biographer of Lord Beaverbrook, and others will know that he was the one who was not elected as an Oxford Regius Professor of History. His other tutor was K.B. McFarlane, a distinguished, little-published medievalist. He did further work, in fact, 2 years academic work at the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at the University of London, earned a second B.A., and thus began his interest in European history. Now, I mentioned earlier another career. He began a business career at this stage in his life. He joined Lloyds Bank, brackets foreign, in Paris. His job for the next 2 or 3 years was lending money to industrialists who had manufacturing plants who wished to import raw goods from the empire. His father relaxed as his son was launched in a sensible and respectable business life. After 2 or 3 years and a good deal of soul-searching, our lecturer had an anxious talk with his father and returned to Oxford. His father, our speaker says, was disappointed. Dr. Kitchen, under the tutelage of F.L. Karsten, a distinguished Oxford German scholar, then began his major academic work. He joined the Institute of European History at Mainz, West Germany, and began working on his Oxford doctoral thesis. His interest was in a group of some 30,000 officers who had served in the German army pre-World War I, not in the nuts and bolts of their training, organization, equipment, but in their political role within their country. His degree was earned in 1966. The thesis was published in 1968, and he has since the publication of this thesis, which was published by the Oxford University Press, made this field virtually his own. His thesis was published as the German Officer Corps 1890-1914. Now, since 1968, he's had 6 major publications in this field, and his last book was in 1981. This was a festschrift for F.L. Karsten's 70th birthday. All of his books have been published since he came to Simon Fraser in British Columbia. He joined the faculty at Simon Fraser in 1966 as an assistant professor and was made full professor in 1976. While I've mentioned his fellowship in the Royal Historical Society, I should also tell you that he was elected a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. Our lecture tonight will be from his latest book, and I'm going to give his book a plug. It's in a totally different field. Dr. Kitchen is in the last stages of writing a book to be published by Macmillan's, he hoped by the Christmas book list, so that you can stuff it into your stockings. It'll be entitled British Policy Towards the Soviet Union During the Second World War. And we will tonight have a preview of this book. I should, in order to disabuse you about our speaker being a grind, tell you that he has a place in the Gulf Islands, sails a wooden Thunderbird, and does a little bit of downhill skiing. So he's now one of us. I give you Dr. Kitchen.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it is said that when we die, we hear our whole life flash before us. If it's anything like that, it's most pleasant. It's something I should be looking forward to. Thank you very much indeed for your very generous words. Also, I'd like to thank the Vancouver Institute, particularly Mrs. Nemetz, for inviting me here this evening. It's a great honor to be here. And lastly, of course, the audience. It's incredible that there should be some 500 people here tonight on a Saturday night. Thank you very much indeed for coming. I don't know if this... can you hear at the back? The very first time I used this machine, it picked up my heart beating, which was most alarming, and I thought it really was the end. Well, my talk is about Winston Churchill and the Soviet Union. When we think of Churchill and the Soviet Union, one immediately thinks of him as the most outspoken of the advocates of intervention during the Russian Civil War, or of the as the author of the speech at Fulton, Missouri, which many people regard as the beginning of the Cold War. I wish to discuss, however, his policy towards the Soviet Union during the war, when the Soviet Union was Britain's greatest continental ally. Even before Hitler launched Operation Barbarossa and starting the war in the East, Churchill had been thinking of the Russians as possible partners in the struggle against Nazi Germany. His determination to destroy Nazi Germany was a far stronger emotion than his very strong anti-communism. For as he was to phrase it in a very famous remark, if Hitler were to invade hell, he would promptly sign a pact with the devil. The British cabinet was not particularly alarmed in 1939 when the Russians invaded Poland some 5 days after their German allies, and they were relieved that the Anglo-Polish agreement, which they'd signed some months before, did not oblige them to take any action against them. Churchill went much further than this. He actually welcomed the Soviet invasion of Poland and over-optimistically claimed that it would force the Germans to keep 25 divisions in Poland to keep an eye on such an untrustworthy ally. On the 1st of October in 1939, Churchill gave a talk on the BBC in which he described Russia in a famous phrase as a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. I'll try a Churchill imitation a bit later, but I'm not quite warmed up yet. And he stressed the community of interests between Britain, France, and the Soviet Union, which could clearly be seen through the fog of confusion and uncertainty. Later, in a conversation with the Soviet ambassador, Maisky, he confidently predicted that their two countries would soon be fighting together against Hitler. Churchill was also very pleased at the prospect of a Soviet attack on Finland, and his cabinet colleagues were amazed when he said, "No doubt it appeared reasonable to the Soviet Union to take advantage of the present situation to regain some of the territory which Russia has lost as a result of the last war, at the beginning of which she had been the ally of France and Great Britain. This applied not only to the Baltic territories, but also to Finland. It was to our interests that the USSR should increase their strength in the Baltic, thereby limiting the risk of German domination in that area. For this reason, it would be a mistake for us to stiffen the Finns against making concessions to the USSR." These remarks absolutely astonished the members of the cabinet as they heard it, and the Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, was so appalled by this outburst that he felt obliged to remind the First Lord of the Admiralty that Finland had a perfect right to exist as a sovereign national state. The Soviet Union attacked Finland on the 30th of November 1939, and in Britain, popular enthusiasm for the Finns was immediate and widespread. The British military authorities had no desire to send aid to Finland because they felt that it would all be lost when the spring thaw gave the advantage to the Russians. But even Churchill was swept along by this popular enthusiasm and agreed to release some Fleet Air Arm aircraft for use by the Finns. But his motives were mixed. and he mainly wanted to provide cover for his pet scheme of an attack on Norway to deny the Germans the use of Swedish iron ore. Once the fighting was over in Finland, the main concern of the British with Soviet affairs was to stop the flow of goods to Germany. A suggestion made by the Ministry of Supply in October of 1939 for a bombing raid on the Caucasus oil fields, was taken up and enthusiastically seconded by Churchill, even though it was totally contrary to his belief, of course, that war between Germany and the Soviet Union was inevitable and that Britain would end up fighting on the Soviet side. Fortunately, this madcap scheme was scotched by Halifax and the Prime Minister Chamberlain. With the German attack on France, there was no more talk of a strike against the Soviet Union, and in his first letter as Prime Minister to Stalin, Churchill stressed that German hegemony over Europe was a matter which should concern both Britain and the Soviet Union equally. In October 1940, he told his military advisers that Germany would attack the Soviet Union in the summer of 1941 to grab the oil fields, but this piece of inspired guesswork, and it was pure guessing, was discounted by the British Chiefs of Staff. At the same time, he refused to allow Eden to go to Moscow. In fact, he said to Eden, if you go to Moscow, you'll get arrested and they'll probably shoot you. He refused to let him go, and he counseled somber restraint on our part. Let them do the worrying. There was, of course, mounting evidence that the Soviets had very good reason to be worried. On the 3rd of April, Churchill sent a message for Stalin based on information gleaned from the Enigma decrypts, from the decrypts of the German secret codes. And his message read, "I have sure information from a trusted agent that when the Germans thought they had got Yugoslavia in the net, that is to say, after March the 20th, they began to move 3 out of 4 panzer divisions from Romania to southern Poland. The moment they heard of the Serbian revolution, this movement was countermanded. Your Excellency will readily appreciate the significance of these facts." In other words, had it not been for this revolt in Serbia, the Germans would have been mounting an attack on the Soviet Union. Sir Stafford Cripps, the British ambassador in Moscow at that time, refused to pass this message on to Stalin. He said, "I've already told him this already. I've already reiterated it to the foreign minister, Vyshinsky, and there's no point in telling them again. It's just going to make them suspicious." Churchill was furious with this and unfairly blamed Cripps in his memoirs. He writes, "his obstinate, obstructive handling of this matter for many of the difficulties he was to have later on with Stalin." In fact, at the time, Churchill did not press the matter at all. He makes a great song and dance about it in his memoirs, but it's very unfair. And Cripps was supported by Eden, the Foreign Secretary, by the Foreign Office, and by the Joint Intelligence Committee. In the following weeks, Churchill was really not interested in Soviet affairs at all and didn't write anything about them. And now we have the invasion on the 22nd of June 1941 of the Soviet Union. The news that Germany had invaded the Soviet Union reached Chequers shortly after 4 in the morning, it was more or less about the time it happened, on the morning of June the 22nd. Since Churchill had given strict instructions never to be woken before 8 o'clock in the morning, unless England itself had been invaded, his anxious staff waited impatiently for 4 hours before giving him the news. He was absolutely delighted. He said, "I will broadcast to the nation after the 9 o'clock news," and he sent Anthony Eden, who was staying at Chequers with him, a vast cigar to celebrate. Eden shared the Prime Minister's sense of relief, but not his taste for large Havana cigars before breakfast. Churchill went over the outline of his speech with Cripps, who was staying at Chequers, Beaverbrook, and Lord Cranborne, who was later Lord Salisbury, a prominent figure in the Conservative Party. But he did not consult the cabinet, nor the Foreign Office, nor indeed Eden, who was staying at Chequers. The speech was a really remarkable performance, although the text was finished just before the broadcast began. He began by stressing his undiminished opposition to communism and said that the Nazi regime was indistinguishable from the worst features of communism. But he insisted that in this new situation, the past, with all its follies and its tragedies, wonderful Churchillian phrase, flashes away. And in a most unfortunate phrase, which was to cause a great deal of embarrassment later on, he spoke of Russian soldiers standing on the threshold of their native land, guarding the fields which their fathers have tilled from time immemorial. The Prime Minister was obviously so swept away by his own rhetoric that he forgot that Russian soldiers were actually standing in the Baltic states, and they were also standing in Poland, and they were also standing in large chunks of Romania. This fact, of course, was not forgotten by the Soviets when they argued that the speech gave at least tacit recognition by the British Prime Minister to their conquest since September 1939. A post-mortem was held on the speech later that evening at Chequers. Eden and Cranbourne were appalled. They felt that the majority of the country would object to being the ally of such a ghastly country as the Soviet Union. Churchill argued that communism was totally irrelevant and that it was simply a matter of innocent people being slaughtered by nasty Nazis. And for Churchill, the main priority now seemed to send every possible help to Russia. And this he promised in his first message to Stalin since the invasion. Stalin replied that he wanted a mutual assistance pact and a declaration that neither country would make a separate peace with Germany. Churchill supported this initiative from Stalin, but met with such fierce resistance in the cabinet that he decided that all political issues would have to be postponed until after the war. In a note for the First Sea Lord, Churchill wrote at this time, "As long as they, the Russians, go on, it does not matter so much where the front lies." But to Stalin, whose front was rapidly approaching Moscow, it mattered a very great deal where the front lay. And he instantly demanded a second front, a landing by the British in France, and also major operations in the Arctic. Churchill felt that a landing in France would be a disaster, and after the terrible experiences of Namsos and Crete, which had happened just a few weeks before, he would not even consider an operation in the Arctic. Great was the relief when Stalin told Stafford Cripps in a private conversation that he had no questions and no reproaches about these arguments. And in gratitude, Churchill promised aircraft, raw material, and 3 million pairs of boots. Incidentally, the boots were sent to Russia at 1 shilling and 9 pence more. The cost of it was more than you could buy the same boots in the Army and Navy stores in Victoria. Some Foreign Office official pointed this out. It was very embarrassing. On reconsideration, Stalin then demanded a second front, either in France or the Balkans, capable of drawing off 30 to 40 divisions from the Russian front. Churchill was absolutely furious at this request. He grabbed hold of the Soviet ambassador, Maisky, and said, "Remember that only 4 months ago we in this island did not know whether you were not coming in against us on the German side. Indeed, we thought it quite likely that you would, even when we felt we should win in the end. We never thought our survival was dependent on your action either way. Whatever happens and whatever you do, you of all people have no right to make reproaches to us." Well, this didn't have any effect on Stalin whatsoever. He continued to insist that the British should land between 25 and 30 divisions in France or transport them to the southern USSR via the Iranian Railway. Well, since this was the total sum of British troops in the United Kingdom, Churchill told his military advisers that Stalin was beginning to live in a world of fantasy and attributed the attitude of the Russians to, I quote, the guilt and self-reproach in their own hearts. For the 2 years they had been allied with Nazi Germany. It was therefore decided to break the deadlock by sending Anthony Eden on a trip to Moscow to discuss political issues. Eden's visit to Moscow was, quite frankly, a disaster. He went there empty-handed, and he was treated to repeated demands from Stalin for recognition of claims, the Soviet claims to the Baltic states, and to Finnish territories, which had been won since 1940. Eden tried to fend off these requests by saying, well, the Americans won't accept it. They won't agree to any discussion of post-war frontiers, and after all, we have an Atlantic Charter. Churchill, who was in the United States at this time, in his own words, reclining in the mellow sunlight of Palm Beach, telegraphed to Eden that the Soviet frontiers of 1941 were, I quote, acquired by acts of aggression in shameful collusion with Hitler, and that to recognize them would be contrary to all the principles for which we are fighting this war and would dishonor our cause. The Soviet Union, he argued, had entered the war only when attacked by Germany, having previously shown themselves utterly indifferent to our fate, and indeed they added to our burdens in our worst danger. He was convinced that after the war, the Soviets would need Britain's support to get back on their feet, and therefore it was not necessary to make any concessions whatsoever. The British government would abide by the spirit of the Atlantic Charter, and the Baltic states would be able to decide their own fate by, he said, freely and fairly conducted plebiscites. Well, Molotov now goes to London in May of 1942 to negotiate an Anglo-Soviet treaty, and when he was there, he emphasized the need for a second front and for a post-war settlement. But he was content with a treaty which avoided all these issues, simply promised mutual assistance and a guarantee not to make a separate peace. Churchill was pleased with the treaty and felt that Anglo-Soviet relations were now on a completely different footing. He ordered the service chiefs to prepare raids on the continent later that year and envisaged a full-scale invasion with the Americans in 1943. It soon became all too apparent that time restraints were so great that such raids in September were out of the question. But planning went ahead for a hit-and-run raid at Dieppe, which was to be launched on the 18th of August. The Soviets continued to insist that Molotov had been given a solemn promise that there would be a second front that year and accused the British government of bad faith. The disaster that befell the convoy PQ-17, when 23 out of 34 ships were lost on the way to Murmansk, led to the cancelling of all further convoys, a move which the Soviets interpreted as a refusal to continue to supply the Soviet Union. Churchill reacted to the harsh criticism of the Soviet government by calling for landings in France and also in North Africa in 1942, and when he made this plea to Roosevelt, the president replied that the Russians should be given a firm promise that there would be a second front in 1942. Well, all this was pure wishful thinking, because the torch landings, the landings in North Africa, would make it impossible to mount an invasion of France the same year. The new British ambassador in Moscow, the very colourful Sir Archibald Clark Carr, later Lord Inverchapel, felt that the only way out of this impasse was for the Prime Minister himself to go to Moscow and discuss this matter with Stalin. Churchill agreed, and in spite of his cabinet colleagues' concern about his health, he was in very poor health this time, he arrived in Moscow on the 12th of August. Churchill reacted very badly to Stalin's taunts about the lack of a second front and cancelling of the convoys, and was, as the British ambassador put it, at his bloody worst, and his worst is really bloody. And he came to the conclusion in a dispatch which he sent to the Foreign Office in London that what the Prime Minister really needed was a good root up the arse. Having insulted his guests by arriving at a banquet in his honour, which incidentally was held in Catherine the Great's bedroom, an extraordinary venue which appealed to Clark Carnot in, he arrived at this banquet in his siren suit, which the British ambassador describes as follows: a dreadful garment which he claimed to have designed himself to wear during air raids. It looks like a mechanic's overalls, or still more like a child's rompers or crawlers. All the bourgeois Bolshevists in uniform or in their prim black bourgeois suits stared in utter amazement. Churchill left this dinner in a towering rage and was totally impervious to Stalin's efforts to charm him. Back in his dacha, which was Stalin's personal dacha and specially bugged for the occasion, he swore that he wouldn't speak to Stalin ever again, that he would go next morning back to England. But fortunately, the next morning, Clark Carr and others managed to placate their tiresome visitor and persuade him to meet Stalin again. This meeting was bizarre but successful. They met at about 1 o'clock in the morning. Vast quantities of drink were consumed. Stalin gorged himself on a pig's head, which he gouged the brains out with a huge pocket knife. He dismissed the death of 10 million kulaks during the collectivization program with a shrug and said, "What's one generation?" Nothing very much came of this meeting, but Churchill told his advisers on his return to the dacha, they were all hanging around there fast asleep, came back about 5 in the morning, he said, "What a pleasure it is to work with this great man." Churchill's visit to Moscow was therefore hardly a turning point in Anglo-Soviet relations, but a disastrous rift between Churchill and Stalin had been averted. Churchill was genuinely admired Stalin and felt that his avowal of friendship was really sincere. Subsequently, he was to explain some of his more wayward behavior by suggesting that Stalin was in fact a mere pawn in the hands of his sinister people in the Politburo. This extraordinary idea came, as far as I can make out, from Desmond Morton, who was a private secretary of Churchill's and his principal link with the world of what is usually called intelligence. Back in London, Churchill told the cabinet that he was most impressed by Stalin and had formed the highest opinion of his sagacity. He told the Chiefs of Staff Committee that keeping Russia supplied was one of the 3 or 4 most important vital objects before us. And he felt that this could best be done by clearing the Germans out of northern Norway, where they were harassing the convoys. This operation was called Operation Jupiter, and then resuming the convoys to Murmansk. This was a further example of Churchill's incredible impetuosity, for Operation Torch would also mean that no landing craft would be available for Operation Jupiter. PQ-18, which was sent in September, suffered very heavy losses, and it was decided to stop all further convoys until January of 1943. The terrible casualties suffered in the Dieppe raid dampened the enthusiasm of all but the most ardent of the Second Fronters. At the Casablanca Conference in January of 1943, Churchill and Roosevelt agreed on an invasion of Sicily, prior to an invasion of France, which in turn meant, of course, that there would be no invasion of France before 1944, and therefore the Soviet demand for a second front would have to be further put off. After the victories of Stalingrad and El Alamein and the successful conclusion of the North African campaign, the British government slowly began to turn its attention to the likely shape of the post-war world. Churchill was informed of a Foreign Office proposal for tripartite talks with the Americans and the Russians on the post-war world when he was in bed with pneumonia. The head of the Northern Department, the department which deals with Russian affairs in the Foreign Office, wrote to Clark Carr in Moscow that Churchill, I quote, on seeing the telegram, emitted a series of most vicious screams from his sickbed and ordained that the whole subject of post-war matters should be dropped at once like the hottest of hot bricks. Yet although he did not want to discuss the post-war settlement, he was convinced that Russia would be the overwhelmingly preponderant power in Europe at the end of the war, and proposed that France should be built up as the main European defence against a potentially dangerous Soviet Union. The Soviet Union would not only be would be the only continental power able to use force after the war, and he said, and that to a measureless and unlimited extent. Now, it was clear from the outset that the major problem in post-war frontiers would be the question of the Russo-Polish frontier. By 1943, both the British and American governments were prepared to accept the Curzon Line as the frontier between the two states. But the Polish exile government in London demanded the restoration of the frontiers of the 1st of September 1939, that is, putting the Polish frontier some 150 kilometres to the east of where the Soviets wanted it to be. Churchill had tremendous admiration for the Poles on whose behalf Britain had entered the war and who had fought so hard and so valiantly for the Allied cause. On the other hand, he thought that the London Poles were a tiresome set of intriguers who, with the exception of the Prime Minister, General Sikorsky, lived in a world, he said, of dangerous fantasies. He complained to the Foreign Office that he found their usual fissiparous and subversive agitation singularly irksome. When in April of 1943, the Germans announced the discovery of a mass grave at Katyn, in which were found the bodies of some 10,000 Polish officers, purported to have been shot by the Russians, Churchill's initial reaction was to tell Sikorsky that it was an obvious propaganda move by the Germans. And he urged the cabinet to ignore the whole incident and not allow the Nazis to sow discord among their allies. At the first hint of criticism from the Polish government, Stalin told Churchill that he no longer recognized them. This is the Polish government in London. And then he called on the Prime Minister to get Sikorsky to change the personnel of his government. Churchill sympathized and told Eden, "We must not be too tender with these unwise people. I trust you will be successful in inducing Sikorsky to reconstruct his government." A few weeks later, unfortunately, Sikorsky was killed in a plane crash, and this was a terrible blow to the British government, for there was no other statesman of similar stature among the London Poles, and none who was prepared to seriously negotiate with the Russians. Incidentally, David Irving and Rolf Hochhut wrote an extraordinary play, in which he claims that Churchill murdered Sikorsky. I can't imagine any possible reason why he could have done or should have done. Quite the reverse. They were absolutely heartbroken when he died. As preparations began for the Tehran conference, Churchill was in a belligerently anti-Soviet mood. He felt the Soviets were being singularly uncooperative, particularly on the Polish issue. And at a cabinet meeting on the 5th of October, Churchill announced that Germany would have to be strengthened after the war as a bulwark against the Soviet Union, a suggestion that was warmly supported by General Smuts, who attended this meeting. Eden was horrified at this suggestion and thought that it was part of a larger scheme to wriggle out of a second front, even in 1944, and to build up some kind of Western European anti-Soviet bloc. He decided that if this was indeed the case, he would resign from the government. In any case, Churchill arrived in Tehran tired, frustrated, badly prepared, and heading for a very serious illness, yet another bout with pneumonia. The first encounters between Churchill and Stalin were bibulous once again and spiced with strange humor. Stalin told Churchill, "You are a German, the devil, you are pro-German, the devil is a communist, and my friend God is a conservative." Churchill proposed a toast to the proletarian masses, and Stalin very graciously replied by drinking to the health of the Conservative Party. At this conference, it was agreed that the invasion of France would take place in May or June of 1944, and there was tacit agreement that the Curzon Line was to be an acceptable frontier between Poland and the Soviet Union. Churchill told Stalin that it would not frankly break his heart if Lvov were to go to the Soviet Union, prompting a younger Foreign Office official to croon in the direction of Stalin, "I can't give you anything but Lvov, baby." I wish I could sing. With the aid of three matches, Churchill showed Stalin how Poland would have to be moved westward. Stalin was delighted, but wanted to go further west still. Churchill was furious when Stalin said that after the war, 50,000 Germans would simply have to be lined up against the wall and shot. And he said, "I will not be party to any butchery in cold blood. What happens in hot blood is another matter." Stalin insisted, and at this point Roosevelt rather naughtily suggested a compromise solution to this impasse. He said 49,000 Germans should be shot. And at this, Churchill stormed out of the room in a towering rage and had to be placated by his advisers. Well, on more serious issues, the treatment of the Polish question was so offhand by the British delegation, and by Churchill particularly messing around with matchsticks and things, that Stalin must have felt that it was a matter of very little concern to the British government, and he was delighted that the Western Allies had granted the Soviet Union the right to establish what were euphemistically called friendly governments in Eastern Europe. The problem for Churchill was now to convince the Poles to negotiate with the Russians before the Red Army overran the country, and they would be in no position to resist Soviet demands. The Polish Prime Minister, Mikołajczyk, told the Prime Minister that he could never accept the Curzon Line as 4 million Poles lived on the other side of it. Churchill was getting increasingly annoyed with the Poles' stubbornness and wrote to Eden, "I rather contemplate telling the world that we declared war for Poland and that the Polish nation shall have a proper land to live in, but we have never undertaken to defend existing Polish frontiers, and that Russia, after two wars which have cost her between 20 and 30 millions of Russian lives, has a right to the inexpugnable security of her western borders. They," the Poles, "must be very silly if they imagine we are going to begin a new war with Russia for the sake of a Polish eastern border." He then wrote to Stalin, telling him that he hoped to make the Poles see reason, and he told Eden that the more frustrated he got with the Poles, the more he sympathized with the Russians. He wrote, "The tremendous victories of the Russian armies, the deep-seated changes which have taken place in the character of the Russian state and government, the new confidence which has grown in our hearts towards Stalin, these have all had their effects." This feeling of goodwill towards the Soviets was, as usual, very short-lived. The Russians made it quite plain that they didn't have any intention at all of negotiating with the London Poles, and there was clear indication already that they were thinking of setting up a rival Polish government under their own auspices. Churchill complained that trying to maintain good relations with a communist is like wooing a crocodile. You do not know whether to tickle it under the chin or to beat it on the head. When it opens its mouth, you cannot tell whether it's trying to smile or preparing to eat you up. And yet he still found it necessary to remind the cabinet that, I quote, only Russian sacrifices and victories hold out any prospect of the restoration of a free Poland. There were also problems with President Roosevelt, who was furious when he learnt that Eden and the Soviet ambassador, Gusev, had made a deal over Romania and Greece, which established British and Soviet spheres of influence. Churchill replied angrily that swift action was needed in Greece to stop the country going communist, and that the Russians would be able to do whatever they liked in Romania. Roosevelt would not accept these arguments, and Churchill replied, warning, "It would be quite easy for me, on the general principle of slithering to the left, which is so popular in foreign policy, to let things rip, when the King of Greece would probably be forced to abdicate, and EAM, that was the left-wing communist militia in Greece, the EAM would work a reign of terror in Greece, forcing the villagers and many other classes to form security battalions under German auspices to prevent anarchy. Carried away by a vision of a British policy free from the aggravations of American interference, Churchill even managed to convince himself that he might be able to persuade Tito to support the restoration of the King of Yugoslavia. He too was living in a world of some fantasy. In the summer of 1944, Churchill showed very little concern for Soviet post-war policy. In a widely publicized speech, General Smuts suggested that Britain would have to sponsor a Western bloc to offset Britain's weakness vis-à-vis the Soviets and the Americans. Eden pointed out in the House of Commons that the Dumbarton-Oaks agreement had accepted the idea of regional associations. There was some talk that this Western bloc would also include Germany. Churchill, however, at this moment was horrified when this was suggested, even though he'd suggested a very similar thing himself not so long ago. He still saw Germany as Britain's great enemy. He said that the idea of ever considering the Germans as potential allies was utterly repugnant to him, even though this, as I said, had been actively considered by the chiefs of staff, and the thought had crossed his mind once before. The Foreign Office felt that a Western bloc, which included Germany, would make a clash with the Soviet Union inevitable. The chiefs of staff felt that it was essential to counteract the enormous power of an expansionist Russia. Churchill did nothing to intervene in this fundamental difference of opinion, thus leaving the British government without a coherent post-war policy. Gladwin Jebb, who was in charge of post-hostilities planning, complained bitterly that the Prime Minister was an old autocrat surrounded by his advisers, who was bored with post-war affairs and refused to give the leadership which was so necessary. In spite of the success of the Normandy landings, Anglo-Soviet relations continued to deteriorate. Disagreements over Poland were a major factor, but problems of spheres of influence in the Balkans and in Eastern Europe were also becoming increasingly important. Churchill therefore resolved to go once again to Moscow to demonstrate that the British government was determined to reach a satisfactory settlement of these issues and to show their determination to live up to the spirit of the Anglo-Soviet Treaty. Prime Minister arrived with the Foreign Secretary, Eden, in the Soviet capital on the 9th of October, 1944, and had his first meeting with Stalin that evening. Churchill told Stalin that he stood by the agreement made at Tehran on the Polish frontiers. Stalin promised that he would try to bring the London Poles and the Lublin Poles, this was the other Soviet-sponsored Polish government, to bring these two governments together. When Churchill commented that where there are two Poles, there is one quarrel, Stalin countered that one Pole would begin a quarrel with himself out of sheer boredom. On Italy, Churchill remarked that he did, I quote, did not think much of them as people, but they had a good many votes in New York State. And he appealed to Stalin to soft-pedal the communists, whereupon Stalin got very indignant, and he said that Ercole, who was Palmiro Togliatti, that Ercole was a fiercely independent man who would probably tell him to mind his own business if he tried to interfere in Italian communist affairs. To this astonishing piece of hypocrisy, Stalin added that Togliatti was anyway not an extremist and promised that he would not start any adventures in Italy. On Bulgaria, Stalin remarked that Britain was not a Black Sea country, and he could not see why they should be in any way interested. After a brief discussion of Germany and Japan, Churchill slipped a small piece of paper across the table to Stalin. It's a little piece of paper that's in the public record office in London. On which the following figures were written. Rumania, 90% to Russia. Greece, 90% to Britain. Yugoslavia, 50-50. Hungary, 50-50. Bulgaria, 75% to Russia. Stalin looked at the list, changed Bulgaria to 90%, and ticked it with a big fat blue pencil. A second meeting with Stalin went off very well. He agreed that the British had a vital interest in Yugoslavia, since the Adriatic was part of the Mediterranean, which in turn was Britain's lifeline. On other topics, Churchill felt that Stalin's remark that the Swiss were swine was a trifle exaggerated. Stalin then said that Cromwell was the only man who knew how to treat the Irish, since, I quote, force was the only way to deal with these people. Churchill made a few mild criticisms of Oliver Cromwell's Irish policy, but Stalin dismissed this out of hand by saying that the only reason why the British did not like Cromwell was that he was a dictator. Well, after meeting members of the Polish Lublin Committee, Churchill told Mikołajczyk that he had missed a golden opportunity to negotiate with the Russians and that his intransigence had strengthened the hand of the Lublin Poles. The Polish premier replied that the great powers had decided the frontier question at Tehran, and he was simply being presented with a fait accompli. After which he stormed out of the room. He made a frequent exit of this sort, Churchill did. Churchill did eventually manage to get Mikołajczyk to accept the Curzon line as a line of demarcation, but this compromise was unacceptable to Stalin. Mikołajczyk then said he would return to London and try and get some of his colleagues to accept the Curzon line. In spite of some underhand jibes about the Hess mission, which Churchill attempted to counter by suggesting that Hess's relationship with Hitler had been, quote, abnormal, he was delighted with his meetings with Stalin. He wrote to Clement Attlee, the deputy prime minister who was acting on his behalf in London, we have talked with an ease, freedom, and beau geste never before attained between our two countries. Stalin has made several expressions of personal regard, which I feel were all sincere. But I repeat my conviction that he is by no means alone. Behind the horseman sits dull care. Both Churchill and Eden were pleased with the percentage agreement. It was fiddled around with a little bit between Eden and Molotov later on, and were convinced that Stalin was a man who kept his word. On his return to London, Churchill told the cabinet that the Soviet Union was ready and anxious to cooperate with the British government, and he cautioned that, quote, no immediate threat of war lay ahead of us once the present war was over, and we should be careful of assuming commitments consequent on the formation of a Western bloc that might impose a very heavy military burden upon us. Churchill's opposition to the idea of a Western bloc was due in large measure to the fact that he was dubious whether it would ever be effective. In a note to Eden, he pointed out that it would take France from 5 to 10 years to build up her army. And he added, the Belgians are extremely weak, and their behavior before the war was shocking. The Dutch are entirely selfish and fought only when they were attacked, and then only for a few hours. Denmark is helpless and defenseless, and Norway practically so. For a Western bloc to be effective, he argued, Britain would have to contribute between 50 and 60 divisions, which was clearly absurd, and he asked how anyone could entertain such a preposterous idea. In fact, he'd been entertaining the idea himself for about 6 months, neither here nor there. By the time Stalin gave official recognition to the Lublin Committee, Churchill had already lost interest in the problems of Poland's eastern frontier. He told the cabinet that if the Poles stopped nagging, he might consider trying to persuade Stalin to let them have Lvov at the peace conference, but he added that it didn't matter where the eastern frontier of Poland lay as long as it could be easily compensated for in the west. To Bevin's objections that this would involve moving millions of peoples away from their homes, he replied that he saw no problem with this, as the Russians and the Turks had done a very good job of this sort of thing in the past. Churchill did try to stop Poland getting the Western Neisse at Yalta. There was a discussion, as you know, between whether it should be the Western Neisse or the Eastern Neisse, telling Stalin, it would be a great pity to stuff the Polish goose so full of German food that it died of indigestion. Stalin countered this by saying this was absolutely no problem at all, as the Germans had all run away. He magnanimously agreed to free elections in Poland, saying that in spite of the efforts of the London Poles, the Russians were seen in Poland as liberators. And he added that the western frontier of Poland could be settled at the peace conference. Alexander Cadogan, who was the permanent Undersecretary of the Foreign Office, head of the Foreign Office, was very distressed at Churchill's performance at Yalta and described him in a letter to his wife as that silly old man, and still felt that they had got an agreement, I quote, got an agreement on Poland which may heal differences for some time at least and assure some degree of independence for the Poles. Churchill was also delighted with the Yalta conference and told the cabinet that as far as Premier Stalin was concerned, he was quite sure that he meant well to the world and to Poland. Stalin had told him that he had committed many sins in the past and had no intention to commit any more. And Churchill felt no doubt whatever that in saying that, Premier Stalin had been sincere. He told his colleagues that the Soviets were behaving very well in Greece and that when the Russians gave their word, they kept it. Shortly after this cabinet meeting, he said, poor Neville Chamberlain believed he could trust Hitler. He was wrong, but I don't think I'm wrong about Stalin. Gradually, Churchill began to realize that he had been outwitted by the Russians at Yalta, and that expressions such as democratic and anti-fascist meant quite different things to Stalin than they did to him. and he therefore decided to make a direct appeal to Stalin in the hope that there was some substance to the friendship which he believed existed between them. At the end of March, he addressed the Soviet leader. "No one has pleaded the cause of Russia with more fervor and conviction than I have tried to do. I was the first to raise my voice on June the 22nd, 1941. It is more than a year since I proclaimed to a startled world the justice of the Curzon Line for Russia's western frontier. And this frontier has now been accepted by both the British Parliament and the President of the United States. It is as a sincere friend of Russia that I make my personal appeal to you and to your colleagues to come to a good understanding about Poland with the Western democracies and not to smite down the hands of comradeship in the future guidance of the world which we now extend." Stalin, however, was in no mood to be soothed by these words. He had just learnt that the British and Americans were negotiating for the surrender of German troops in Italy without even consulting their Soviet allies, which was a clear violation of the Anglo-Soviet Treaty. The Soviet-sponsored coup d'etat in Romania in February of 1945 did not trouble Churchill unduly. He felt that as the Soviets had been extremely scrupulous over Greece, it would be impossible to complain about Romania. He wrote to the president as follows: "Since the October Anglo-Russian conversations in Moscow, Stalin has subscribed on paper to the principles of Yalta, which are being trampled down in Romania. Nevertheless, I am most anxious not to press this view to such an extent that Stalin will say, quote, 'I did not interfere with your action in Greece. Why do you not give me the same latitude in Romania?' Unquote." There was general agreement in Whitehall that the Soviet domination of Romania was a fair price to pay for a free hand against the left in Greece. And Churchill showed a similar lack of concern with the course of events in Bulgaria and even Hungary, where the Soviet forces were far more cooperative and flexible. But by May of 1945, Churchill was getting increasingly concerned as the Soviet Union tightened its grip on Eastern Europe. On the 18th of May, he gave a luncheon for Gusev, the Soviet ambassador, and said to his somewhat startled guest, in response to his own question as to how the Russians were responding to the new situation in Europe, "By dropping an iron screen across Europe from Lübeck to Trieste, behind which we have had no knowledge of what was happening. All we know was that puppet governments were being set up about which we were not consulted and at which we were not allowed to peep. All this is incomprehensible and intolerable. The Prime Minister and His Majesty's government objected in the strongest terms to being treated as if they were of no account in the after-war world. They felt that they still counted for something, and they refused to be pushed about. Their determination not to see this happen had moved them to postpone the demobilization of the Royal Air Force." This is the first mention of the Iron Curtain, of course, which comes in this version as the Iron Screen, a less felicitous phrase, probably. As the war drew to a close, Churchill became obsessed with the view held by the post-hostilities planners that the Soviet Union was a potentially deadly enemy, which posed a real threat to the British Empire. With the explosion of the first atomic bomb over Japan, Churchill began to imagine that he'd found a solution to all his problems. The chief of the Imperial General Staff wrote in his diary that Churchill, quote, "at once painted a wonderful picture of himself as the sole possessor of these bombs and capable of dumping them where he wished, and thus all-powerful and capable of dictating to Stalin." Alan Brooke, the chief of Imperial General Staff, who was keenly aware that Russia was now all-powerful in Europe, was appalled at such talk, for there were all kinds of problems of production and delivery of atomic bombs, and it was obvious that sooner or later the Soviets would build their own. When he heard that the planners were considering the possibility of a war with the Soviet Union, he, that's Alan Brooke, wrote, "The idea is, of course, fantastic, and the chances of success quite impossible." At the end of the war, the Foreign Office tended to think of the Soviet Union as a country obsessed with its own security, and although its policies in Eastern Europe were brutal and the disregard shown to its allies was reprehensible, its policy was understandable and did not pose a real threat to vital British interests. The post-hostilities planners, who came partly from the Foreign Office, partly from service departments, the post-hostilities planners felt that this was hopelessly misguided and optimistic and began to think of the Soviet Union as being as great a threat as Nazi Germany had been, and in fact even greater. Churchill wavered between these two positions. He was unable to make up his mind whether Stalin was his friend and partner with whom he could help to construct a peaceful and secure Europe, or whether he was determined to dominate Europe and destroy the British Empire. At Potsdam, Churchill no longer felt that Stalin was a friend he could trust, as he'd done at Yalta, but he had not yet reverted to his full-blooded anti-communist militancy as he was to do at Fulton, Missouri. Behind all this uncertainty was the slow and painful realization that Britain's power and prestige had declined drastically, and this superb 19th century prime minister was in command of a state which had long since ceased to be a truly great power. It was a mark of Churchill's genius that this fact was often disguised, and his influence on the course of the war and on the political settlement which followed it was out of all proportion to the resources at his command. His greatest weakness was his inability to face the fact of Britain's decline and to tailor his policies accordingly. Britain and the Soviet Union had been brought together by Hitler's lust for conquest, and for no other reason. The old suspicions and misunderstandings were bound to resurface as soon as the German menace was crushed. Churchill's policy towards the Soviet Union vividly reflects this central fact. However much he loathed communism and the Soviet system, he knew that Britain needed the support of the Soviet Union against Germany, and was even prepared to accept Soviet expansion in the Baltic, Poland, and in Finland, and indeed in Eastern Europe generally, in order to secure that support. But Churchill was seldom consistent and was easily carried away by such madcap schemes as his proposal to attack the Soviet oil fields in the spring of 1940. His fertile and restless brain never concentrated for long on any one topic, and it is astonishing how little attention he paid to Soviet affairs, even though he was one of the first to realize how important the Soviet Union would be for the defeat of Germany. He was never able to make up his mind about the Soviet Union, and his reactions to Soviet moves were often impulsive and ill-considered. For example, no contingency plans were made for a Soviet defeat in 1941, even though this was expected. Nobody in Britain, from the intelligence down, thought that the Soviet Union would last for more than 6 weeks against a German attack. And the consequences of a Soviet defeat in 1941 for Britain would have been catastrophic. Although he came round to the belief that concessions would have to be made over the Baltic states and Poland, and the undertaking not to negotiate a separate peace, unlike Stafford Cripps, he failed to realize that these were vitally important questions for the Soviet Union and had to be settled quickly if any political benefit was to be gained. Similarly, Churchill never appreciated how serious the issue of the Second Front was to the Soviet government, and that by delaying the Second Front, he was weakening the hand he had to play. The Italian campaign was painfully slow. failed to draw German forces from the Eastern Front, and further delayed the invasion of France. Supplies sent to the Soviet Union were relatively modest, and the cancellation of the convoys further damaged relations between the two countries. All this meant that Churchill had very little to offer the Russians and nothing to offset their power in Eastern Europe. It was typical of Churchill to overestimate the value of personal contacts with other statesmen and to imagine a friendship where none existed. He seriously misjudged Stalin the man and failed to realize the dominant role he played in the Soviet state. His feelings towards the Soviet leader changed rapidly, just as his feelings of genuine sympathy for the Soviet people could easily turn to distrust and frustration. In his single-minded determination to defeat the Germans, he seriously neglected the Soviet Union and undervalued their contribution to the common cause. Then, in the final stages of the war, he realized that the Soviet Union was all-powerful in Eastern Europe and that there was nothing that could be done to dislodge them. It therefore seemed that the Yalta Agreement was extremely satisfactory to the Western Allies and that the Soviets had made real concessions. But when the full extent of British powerlessness in the very moment of victory became apparent, and when the Soviets began to implement their version of democracy and anti-fascism in their sphere of influence, Churchill reacted in bitter frustration, but even the atom bomb could not redress the balance. Even at his most pessimistic, Churchill never considered the possibility of continuing the war against the Soviet Union. He shared the common feeling that the communists were, after all, preferable to the Nazis. And since they were no longer revolutionaries, he thought, or fanatical ideologues, the people of Eastern Europe could reasonably expect a decent and dignified future, for the Soviet satellite system had yet to be fully implemented. Was it therefore the case that Churchill was blind to the true nature of Stalin's Russia and seduced by his assurances of friendship? Or was an opportunity, however difficult and remote, to build on the foundations of a great wartime partnership lost in the moment of victory? Posing the question in this manner overlooks the fact that there were two partners in the alliance, that neither side was blameless, suspicions and betrayals were mutual, and any policy, however shrewd, however enlightened, depends for its success on the responses it meets. For all his mistakes, Churchill did well in an exceedingly difficult situation. He was neither a wanton antagonist to the Soviet Union, nor did he mindlessly appease them. He was operating with dwindling funds and diminishing returns, and like all men, however great, was powerless to alter the great decisions of history. Thank you very much.
As usual, we'll have... Is this thing working? Is it working now?
You're no? Talking to my tie.
Well, we'll talk into this one then. We'll take questions, if there are any. Is it met?
Feel that is it still ideological power, or is it still Mother Russia, pre-enlightenment, pre-democracy?
I can hold this thing. Do I understand the question that what did Churchill think of? Oh dear, I have enough difficulties trying to work out what other people think rather than my own. I think there was obviously a bit of both. I mean, clearly during the war there was a reversion in Russia to sort of traditional Russian forms and a playing up of patriotism and the Russian past, the great patriotic war, a downplaying of the ideological element, for example, the abolition of the Communist International, which was seen as a major step away from sort of revolutionary movements. I think that for reasons largely of expediency, the Russians were, they were getting what they wanted by natural means, if you like, without needing to take a revolutionary stance. Certainly they were playing that down, you know.
I wonder if you would elaborate on the extent to which Churchill really considered what you might call atomic blackmail against Stalin. Did he really consider the use of the bomb, or is it just a fleeting idea?
I think it was really a fleeting idea. I mean, he was... the question was, did Churchill seriously think of dropping the bomb on the Russians, or using it as a threat or whatever, or was this just a fleeting idea? It was basically a fleeting idea, because when the bomb went off, as I said, he was absolutely delighted. He said, this is fantastic. Here we are, utterly powerless. We have no troops left at all. There's this huge conventional army overrunning the whole of Eastern Europe. We have no idea whether the Americans are going to stay in Europe. They're probably going to go home into splendid isolation. The country's bankrupt. And there's no money left. They couldn't even find any money to lend the Russians. I think it came up £3 million or something in 1945. So the bomb's the thing. This will solve all our problems. We're a great power again. See, and he said this in a moment, and but all the service chiefs said, look, this is simply not on, and this is impossible, because we've only got a handful of these things. We don't know whether they'll go off, and we have to produce a lot of them, and we don't know if they'll get to their target, and forget about it. It's insane. I mean, he does come back to this theme, of course, later on in the Fulton speech itself, but at the time, no, he didn't really seriously believe it. He hoped that it would redress the balance, but it clearly wasn't going to. Yes?
Did you assess that Churchill's drinking habits were interfering with
the... the question was, were Churchill's drinking habits interfering with his assessment of political... difficult to judge, isn't it? I mean, he did drink enormous quantities, I mean, far more than most people could tolerate. His biographer, Martin Gilbert, is very sternly reminds us that when he drank whiskey, he always watered it down. But he still managed to consume very, very large quantities of whiskey, however much it was watered down. It started before breakfast. I don't know. I don't think there's any evidence that it did, although he was generally not a very healthy man, certainly by the end of the war. I mean, whether this was attributable to the fact that he drank too much, or that he ate too much, or he smoked too much, or he didn't sleep enough, or didn't take any exercise, or was working too hard, I don't know. But he was certainly not a particularly healthy man. And this you can read about in his physician's diaries, which are very interesting, Lord Moran's diaries. Although his physician, of course, he didn't seem to think that drinking that much was going to do him any harm, nor smoking all these cigars. Physicians are so much more enlightened these days, aren't they? Sorry.
What is the present state of Russian history writing? It's really shown that you're going to get any valid objective description of these episodes from Russian sources?
No, I find that most of the Russian, I mean, I can't read Russian, but some of it does come out in English language journals, is that there are two things. First of all, that really the British government wanted to turn the Germans against the Soviet Union, and what they really would have liked to have done would have to fought with the Germans against the Soviets, but unfortunately they sort of messed it up in 1939 and got their alliance system wrong. And secondly, that the British deliberately held up the second front in France so that the Russians would get bled to death, or if not bled to death, then at least very, very seriously weakened. It's probably true that it might have been possible, had strategy been different, to have launched the Second Front earlier. I think it's also true that the British authorities didn't give the Second Front the sort of priority they should have done, certainly if they wanted to have decent relations with the Soviet Union. But there's absolutely no evidence at all that the British were sort of deliberately holding up the Second Front in order to hurt the Russians. But that is the basic Russian position, that that Churchill all along was anti-Soviet.
You gave a view of a two-party relationship between Churchill and Stalin, and in that view, the American President Roosevelt and then Truman are treated primarily as spectators. Is that a reasonable approximation, do you think, to what happened?
The question was, here's Churchill facing Stalin, and the way I presented things was that the American president, Roosevelt, and then Truman were merely spectators, this magnificent duel going on between the two of them. No, of course, it's not really true, and the American influence was very important. But I think that for Churchill, the Americans were a very useful excuse a lot of the time. I mean, when he didn't want to do something, he would tell Stalin or tell the Soviet ambassador, look, we'd love to help you out, but unfortunately these wretched Americans who really don't understand anything about politics at all won't go along with it. And they have this silly Atlantic Charter with all these idealistic ideas about freedom and stuff, which you and I know is really strictly propaganda. And it was useful. It was useful for him to play that card. And of course, there are many times when Churchill could override the American, or convince the Americans, for example, the whole Mediterranean strategy, to go into North Africa and then into Sicily, into Italy, rather than to go first to France, was Churchill's idea rather than American. Sorry.
First World War, Russia. Do you know of any reaction from Churchill regarding the Russian invasion of Manchuria right at the end of the Second World
War? No, there's no. The question was, what were Churchill's reactions or statements on the Russian operations in Manchuria at the end of the Second World War? To my certain knowledge, there is nothing in the public records, I mean all the papers of the Prime Minister and of the Foreign Office, that has anything on that at all. He didn't really comment on it. In fact, he really doesn't comment very much on Soviet affairs at all. It's really extraordinary that here is the greatest ally of the British, at least on the continent. And very, very little of his attention was turned towards them. And certainly Manchuria didn't interest him at all.
Any questions behind the bar?
There's a newspaper on it.
Question that I have, that we read a lot and hear a lot about the Allies, particularly the British, having broken the German code and more or less knew beforehand almost everything that they were going to do. Did a similar thing happen to the British? Were they able to break the Russian code so that they could, you might say, be rigged have the answers before the Russians more or less knew the questions?
The question was, if I can repeat it for people who didn't hear it, was we know that the British cracked the German codes. Did they crack the Russian ones? This is a very, very difficult question to answer because all the documents dealing with this problem have been classified. No one can see them. And even the official historians of British intelligence during the Second World War, a team of historians under F.H. Hinsley were publishing a vast series on intelligence during the war. They got to about volume 3, I think, about 3,000 pages. There's in this book, there's just one rather laconic statement which says the British intelligence agreed to stop listening to Russian messages on the 22nd of June 1941 when they became allies. Now, I find that impossible to believe, quite frankly. In other words, it admits that they were listening in to Soviet military and no doubt diplomatic ciphers up until 1941, to June of 41, and I would be very, very surprised if they didn't go on doing it. And one of the strongest pieces of evidence for this is that the Russians simply refused to give any proper information to the British, particularly the British military mission in Moscow, about where their troops were positioned. And it was very difficult to actually support an ally. We didn't really know what he was doing and where he was placing his troops. And the British really didn't seem to worry about this very much. And I think the answer was that the British knew exactly where these troops were anyway and didn't have to ask them. Well, that's my guess. But it's simply a hunch, and you won't be able to find out because you won't be able to see the documents. And...
Wait there.
10,000 Polish officers that were executed. What's the current theory on that? Who's responsible?
Oh, I think that almost everyone, unless you have extraordinary ideological biases, would agree that the Russians did it. I mean, the evidence is absolutely overwhelming that these Polish officers, there were between 10 and 13,000, were shot. When that part of Poland, it's sort of near Smolensk, was under Russian occupation. The Germans dug up the grave, and of course the charge was that the Germans had shot them and then blamed the Russians. If you look at the evidence impartially, it was examined in great detail in the British Foreign Office and the legal section of the Foreign Office. If you look at it, I think you really can't come to any other conclusion. The only person, there were two people who said that it was obvious that the Russians, that the Germans were responsible for the massacre. One of them was a young and promising diplomat who had nearly been sent to Moscow as press attaché because he was so interested in Soviet affairs and was so brilliant, a young man by the name of Guy Burgess. The other person was the famous Marxist historian, at that time member of the Communist Party, Christopher Hill, who was the principal advisor to the Foreign Office on Soviet affairs, who argued that the Soviet document trying to prove that the Germans had done this atrocious crime was so silly and so shot full of contradictions and so improbable that it must be true. It couldn't possibly be a forgery. If they were going to forge it, they wouldn't do such a lousy job of it. As far as the British government was concerned, from Churchill down, they all believed that the Russians had done it, and they just wished it would go away. Churchill, you know, they just didn't want to bring it up. Churchill said, it's no use prowling around the four-year-old graves of Smolensk. No good will come of it. In other words, they wanted to hush it up. And they refused to cooperate when the Germans offered a free Red Cross mission to go and look at the graves. But I think almost everyone, certainly everyone in Poland today, would agree that it was the Russians what done it. Yeah.
Did you get the Warsaw Uprising?
Hmm?
Did Stalin sacrifice three people, or was he capable in the beginning?
I think, again, from the evidence, the question was, was the Red Army sort of deliberately waiting outside Warsaw when there was the uprising in Warsaw and allowing the people of Warsaw to be slaughtered before they liberated the city? I think the evidence is pretty overwhelming that the Russians were genuinely stopped on the Vistula, that they couldn't get across, and that they weren't sort of deliberately stopping to allow the Poles in Warsaw to be crushed. On the other hand, there is no question at all that the Russians were absolutely delighted that the people of Warsaw were crushed. They saw them as enemies and rivals, which they were. They were as strongly opposed, most of them, the Polish Home Army to the Russians as they were to the Germans. The Russians also refused until the very, very last moment to allow British planes, for example, to fly from Russian bases, which were only sort of about 150 kilometers away from the city. They couldn't use these Russian airfields. They had to fly all the way from Bari in southern Italy. It was a very dangerous flight to go all the way from Bari to Warsaw, and they lost a terrible lot of planes from it. They wouldn't do it until the very last moment. And they did actually send a couple of NKVD agents into Warsaw, but very late in the game, and actually both of them got killed by the Germans, so they didn't do anything. But the answer is no, they didn't deliberately stop there, but on the other hand, they were delighted that they couldn't help, or they refused to give any help. Oh, sorry. Looking the wrong.
What was the Russian response to the German invasion of Britain in the very early part of the war? Yeah, I'm wondering to tie it into the Great Britain response.
You mean the Battle of Britain?
Yeah.
Oh well, the question is what was the Russian response to the attempted invasion by the Germans of Britain, and specifically the Battle of Britain. The answer was that, first of all, this war was a war between two imperialist powers, but of which two of them were equally awful, one more equal than the other. That is to say that given the choice, on the whole, the Germans were better than the British. And that was certainly the line taken by the Communist International. It was certainly the line taken by the British Communist Party, which was urging people not to support the war effort. And the like.
Thank you. We'll use this.
Well, thank you formally.
You can sit and enjoy the balance.
I'm going to ask on behalf of all of us, Dr. Sewell, president of Simon Fraser University, to thank our speaker.
I think that thank yous should have three qualities. They should be brief, in fact, very brief. They should be flattering, and they should be sincere. I am absolutely convinced I can accommodate all three this evening with no difficulty at all. It's a tremendous thrill for me to be not only the president of Simon Fraser University, which has the quality of faculty of Martin's quality, but also to be a colleague of his in the history department. In fact, I gave a research seminar to my colleagues in history a few weeks ago and had the unparalleled compliment after of Martin Kitchen coming up to me and saying, "Not bad." Martin, I think you've reminded us tonight, in a time when there's such pressure on education to be, quote, relevant, whatever that means, that relevance certainly does include the humanities, history, the arts, and we're thankful for that. We're also thankful that despite the economic difficulties in British Columbia and our collective inability to have the will, it seems to me, to give higher education and education generally the priority that we must as a free society which wishes both to remain free and to develop, that people of Martin Kitchen's quality are prepared to stay in our universities. Thank you, Martin, very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, I remind you that Sir Stuart Hampshire, Warden of Wadham College, Oxford, will speak to us next week, the 9th of March at 8:15, on the topic past and present in the morality of politics. It might be relevant.